This is the Talk of Iowa Book Club. I'm Charity Nebbe. Little House on the Prairie by Laura Ingalls Wilder and The Birch Bark House by Louise Erdrich are two books for young readers. They both tell the stories of young girls who lived at about the same time. In Little House on the Prairie, we follow Laura Ingalls and her family of pioneers as they travel west in search of a homestead. The Birch Bark House tells the story of Omakeas and her Ojibwe family living on Madeline Island in Wisconsin. We've been reading both books because together they tell a fuller and richer story of our past. Pull up a comfy chair. It's time for Book Club.
The best way to grow a podcast is by word of mouth. So if you love this podcast, subscribe, like, and share with your friends.
This is the Talk of Iowa Book Club. Little House on the Prairie was first published 85 years ago in 1935. It tells the story of the Ingalls family, white settlers traveling west to Kansas to homestead in what was then called Indian Territory. It's based on the experiences of the author and her family. In this book, Laura is a little girl, about 6 years old. She lives with her ma and pa, her perfect older sister Mary, baby sister Carrie, and their good old bulldog Jack. The Little House series has sold over 60 million copies worldwide and is still widely read. The Birch Bark House was published in 1999, the first book for young readers written by critically acclaimed novelist Louise Erdrich. This book also revolves around family life, an Ojibwe family living on Madeline Island in Wisconsin. And at the center of the story is a little girl named Omakeas. She lives with her mother, father, grandmother, her perfect older sister Angeline, an annoying little brother named Pinch, and an adorable baby brother known as Niwo. The book is inspired by the Erdrich's family history, and it's the beginning of a series that has 5 published books so far, with a plan for 8. Eventually, the series will span a full century that will follow the path of Erdrich's Ojibwe ancestors as they were forced to move westward to make way for white settlers. We'll explore some of the themes in both books with Sarah Utoff, a Laura Ingalls Wilder authority, and Christine Nobis, an Indigenous rights activist and organizer. As we begin our conversation, I want to acknowledge that the Iowa City studio of Iowa Public Radio, where this was recorded, is on land that was once home to a number of different Native people, including Meskwaki, Sauk, Sioux, Iowa, and Kickapoo. With me now is Brent Criswell. He's a public school teacher, 5th grade, and along with his wife, operates The Good Earth, providing nature-based education. Every year, he reads both of these books with his students. Hello, Brent.
Hello, Charity. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And tell me about your inspiration to teach these books in your 5th grade class. That's not a required part of the curriculum. This was kind of your own innovation.
Yeah, I guess it stemmed from our language arts textbook. We had a story in there called The Birch Bark House, and it was just a fragment of the entire book, and really enjoyed the story, but I felt that there was a lot of context that was missed just by reading that little fragment. So I went and talked with a librarian, and she told me that, or she basically gave me the whole book to look over and read, and I did, and I really enjoyed it, and felt that it was valuable content to read as an entire book. And then, I don't know, maybe a month later, I was looking into another book to use as a group. And, I was thinking Little House on the Prairie. And, you know, after discussing with my librarian, came to the conclusion that these two books would be paired up really nicely together and we could have some really good discussions.
And your librarian did say, you know, there have been concerns about reading Little House on the Prairie in schools in recent years because of the depiction of Native people in the book. Did that give you pause?
That usually doesn't give me pause, but it makes me think, okay, why is this book being pulled out of schools, or why is it not being used as much as it was? And I usually think of that as a kind of a cool opportunity to dive into something. I just jumped all over it and went after it and turned out to be a good decision.
Well, and when you read the books, we're going to talk about some of the similarities between the books in a moment. But when you read the books with the students, you also do an education process to help them understand what was happening, really, with westward expansion and the expulsion of Native people from the land.
Yeah, completely. A lot of our year, especially in fifth grade in Iowa here, we have American history. So we study westward expansion in social studies. There's so much to learn in that topic. We start to break it down. You know, what are pioneers? What are pioneer families? What is westward expansion in general? We look at it from obviously the settlers' perspectives. Then we also study the natives' perspectives. How are they affected by all this? And what were they thinking? And that's what makes these two books great, because it gives us both perspectives and we can compare them and contrast them. And a lot of the things that happened can really be seen in both of these books and discussed. You know, and I also like to throw in some extra resources, too, that gives us some more details to look at, too, and basically other pieces of the puzzle.
It's interesting, Brendan, we will talk about this a great deal more later in the hour, but when I think about what I learned in Iowa history was what we were taught in fifth grade, and as I continued to learn about U.S. history, I really did not come to even the beginning of a full understanding about really the genocide perpetrated against Native people in this country until significantly later, and I had a realization of, oh, I'm reading about a Holocaust, and that was not the way that I learned this history when I was in school. And talking with my kids, it sounds like maybe not that much has changed since I was a student. From your perspective, what do you think about, has our history curriculum moved forward on that and given us a more realistic picture?
That's a good question. I would say it's moved forward a little bit. Definitely lots more room for growth in that area. But I think there has to be intent from the teachers. You know, if you just stick to the, just stick to the textbooks, or if you were to only have read Little House on the Prairie and nothing else, and just simply read it as a book for what it is, you'd be missing huge pieces of history. If you go into it with the intent of, really diving in and looking at all these perspectives and what was really happening, that maybe the textbooks don't mention or Little House doesn't mention, then you might be doing a disservice. So you really have to be open-minded and look for these extra resources that really make a well-rounded picture of history in this time period.
I have read several interviews with Louise Erdrich, the author of The Birchbark House, and of course we invited her to be part of the show today, but she is a very busy woman. She read the Little House on the Prairie books when she was growing up, as really almost everybody of a certain generation did, or several generations, in fact. And she wanted to write about her family history. And, this is a really incredible saga that over the 8 books in this series is going to take place over, 100 years of history. But when you look at Little House on the Prairie and you look at the Birchbark House, there are some similarities between the books. And I want to start with the girls at the center of these stories. Of course, again, many people are familiar with Laura. We know that she's bright and she's inquisitive and she sometimes has a hard time controlling her temper and being good and feels a lot of pressure to be as good as her big sister, Mary. And then in the Birchbark House, we meet Omakeas, who is about the same age, and she is bright and she is inquisitive and she loves nature and adventure, and she feels a lot of pressure to be as good as her big sister Angeline, and she can't stand her little brother Pinch. So these girls are both so engaging and so relatable. How does your class respond to them?
They really, really enjoyed all the characters in both the books. I think that's one of the things that both artists do extremely well. They make these characters very relatable. The family dynamics, having siblings, the annoying ones, the ones you envy or look up to. And part of the questioning that I do is, I have them compare the characters and then also compare to their own lives.
The both families, of course, are living very close to the elements, are incredibly vulnerable to the elements. And that's something that, of course, we're so far away from as modern Americans, I think. Do the students, are they sort of taken aback by how vulnerable these families are?
Yeah, they are. And we do kind of pause the book from time to time and talk about what it would be like if we were in this scene in the book, you know, where they have like in the Little House on the Prairie, where they're building the cabin and they have the dirt floors and, you know, they just have no windows or blankets on the walls or, and then when winter comes, you know, how cold is it going to be? You know, can you imagine not having heat or just having a little fireplace in your house? And that'd be it. Same thing with the Birch Bark House.
I'm talking with Brent Criswell, a teacher who reads both of these books with his fifth grade students every year. In a moment, we will meet our other expert readers. This is the Talk of Iowa Book Club.
If you love this podcast, you should know that just like all the content produced by IPR, it's fueled by listener dollars. Hi, I'm Caitlin Harrop, and I'm a producer working on the Talk of Iowa Book Club. Part of my job is talking with the guests and experts you hear on this podcast to bring thought-provoking, informative conversations to listeners like you. And when you contribute to IPR, you make those conversations possible. Membership contributions are the single largest source of funding for IPR's budget, so every dollar counts. Do your part to support the podcasts and programs you enjoy. Go to iowapublicradio.org and tap on the red donate button. Thank you.
This is the Talk of Iowa Book Club. I'm Charity Nebbe. We have been reading two books, books for young readers, Little House on the Prairie by Laura Ingalls Wilder, published in 1935, and The Birch Bark House by Louise Erdrich, published in 1999. Both books take place over the span of a year and revolve around family life during the same period in history. In Little House on the Prairie, we follow a family of white settlers. In The Birch Bark House, it's an Ojibwe family, living in mostly traditional ways, but threatened by the presence and pressure of white traders and settlers. With me is Brent Criswell. He is a public school teacher who teaches fifth grade. And it is time to introduce our other expert readers. Sarah Utoff is a Laura Ingalls Wilder authority. She is also an authority on one-room schools, historic foodways, and living history. Her website is trundlebedtrails.com. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here. And tell me a little bit. I obviously, as a Laura Ingalls Wilder authority, I know that you have a deep and long-lasting relationship with the Little House books. But tell me what you remember about first encountering these books.
Well, when my mom was pregnant with me, she had a friend of hers tell her that if she was having a little girl, she had to get these Little House books. Now, my mom didn't know anything about them. She was a Black Stallion fan. But she was looking at garage sales, and she got me a set of the books. And so, really, before I can even remember, they were reading me the books.
And what do you think resonated with you so strongly? Because this has clearly become a very important part of your life.
I really strongly associated with Laura, partly because, you know, the way she's written, that she's tries to be good and kind, and she doesn't always feel like being good and kind. And she, you know, is brave, but she isn't brave like, you know, Superman, where she just doesn't have any fear. She is brave because she has fear, and she does it anyway, because that's what she needs to do to help her family. And I really like all the social history and the agriculture stuff that's in the books. I'm sixth generation Johnson County farmer, and it's really, I think, an important thing for people to know about, and I love reading about it.
And, of course, we also asked you to read The Birch Bark House for this episode, but you had read that book before. Tell me a little bit about your impressions of The Birch Bark House.
Well, I had read it back when it first came out, and really the thing that, and I read it again for this, and the thing that really struck me both times was the first chapter where the traders find the little baby in the village that has been decimated by smallpox. I mean, it is such a strong, vivid scene.
Well, Sarah, stay with us. I want to bring our next expert reader into the conversation as well. Christine Nobis is Plains Cree Soto of the George Gordon First Nation in Saskatchewan. She is also shift director and decolonizer with Seeding Sovereignty. Christine, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And Christine, before we have this conversation, I want to acknowledge that in asking you to read these two books, I've asked you to do more emotional labor than the rest of us who are here, particularly at a time when Native people are being attacked publicly by the president and other high-profile individuals. I can imagine that this must be a difficult time, but thank you so much for being part of this.
I'm happy to do it.
So, Christine, you also encountered the Little House on the Prairie books as a child, as most people do. Tell me a little bit about your relationship with those stories.
I was a pretty prolific reader at a young age, and I think I encountered these, you know, early on. And I don't recall reading more than just Little House on the Prairie. I do remember as a child reading how they discussed indigenous people or Indians, I guess you will, and having a reaction to it, but just also, you know, being used to Indians being depicted that way. So I you know, didn't go much further than that. But reading them as adult, as an adult, is a very different situation.
Yeah. And it was an interesting experience for me, and I'm sure that both Sarah and Brent could speak to this as well. Going back and reading these books as an adult, I didn't remember, but shocked by how much talk about Indians in a really derisive way there is. And that was something that Louise Erdrich has said about this. She says, with the Birch Bark House, she loves the fact that people are reading the Birch Bark House and the rest of the books along with the Little House on the Prairie books. And this is taken from an interview that she did. She says, because one of the things about the Laura Ingalls Wilder books that always distresses me is Ma's racism. She's a terrible racist about Native people. And there's also inherent racism in the structure of the Wilder books themselves, the simple acceptance of the fact that the Little House characters could just go along and take whatever they wanted and that the Native people were apparently vanishing into the sunset. The Native were portrayed as vanishing people who were going to go away, and that's all that one could feel about them. So those are Louise Erdrich's words on that. Tell me about the Birch Bark House. Was this a book that you had read before we asked you to?
No. You know, the Birch Bark House is a beautifully written book that tells a real story about real issues that Indigenous people were facing back in the early or mid 1800s. And so, you know, I don't really have much to say about it, except that I'm happy that it was written. It's a great resource for children, and that it should be read in place of books like Little House on the Prairie. Little House on the Prairie really is a book of indoctrination. And I have no clue why this book is being taught at all in any school whatsoever. And also, even if it is being taught, like, I don't know how it's being taught. I'm not even sure if the teacher that was just on is teaching it in the way that it should be taught. For instance, like, are people really talking about, are they really picking apart, you know, the aspects of this book that are very, very problematic? In fact, I feel like this book should be taught in a history class that provides a perspective of settler vigilantes and colonial militias that came into our lands and perpetuated genocide and ethnic cleansing. And in fact, I just want to like quickly quote somebody, Francis Kay, who wrote a paper called Little Squatter on the Osage Diminished Reserve, who says, Wilder, writing as honestly as she knew how, spun a tale that, because of her very decency, makes ethnic cleansing appear palatable. And so I do think that even though we are living right now in this day and age, the fact that this book is still accepted and so loved and so highly regarded is extremely problematic and does not at all go into, you know, the teachings around it are not as intricate as they should be. We're not talking about removal, reservations, assimilation, colonization, genocide, all of the settler violence inflicted upon Indigenous peoples. We're not talking about the theft of land, why these Indians were going into their house. Why were they going into their house and taking things? Well, because they were taking what they believed was rent, or because maybe they were starving, or maybe because they had no place to go because they were running. You know, there's just so much that goes into this that I have no clue why a fifth grade reader is reading this without some very, very serious context going along beside it.
I think that that's a very valid opinion. I do want to give Brent an opportunity to share with us a little bit more about what he does with his class. And Brent, I'm not trying to put you on the defensive. And Christine, I'm not trying to minimize what you were saying. But Brent, knowing a little bit more about what you do with your class, I think might be interesting for everybody, because you have come up with, as you said, you really like to bring other resources into the classroom.
Yeah. Thanks for giving me an opportunity to respond. If this book were taught just in isolation, I would 100% agree with you. And I don't think it should be taught just in isolation and just read through simply by students in a classroom. In fifth grade, we do a lot of American history teaching. And with that, I do my very best to focus on the Indigenous people and everything they went through and all the atrocities. When I teach this book and the Birchbark House, it's not simply just a comparison of the two. We dissect it. We go through the perspectives of both the Ingalls family and the natives, and we try to understand, you know, when you mentioned, you know, why are the Indians going into their house? We ask questions like that. What is going on? Are they hungry? And we talk about the treaty promises that were thrown at these people, and how not all the information was shared with them, how they may not interpret the treaties correctly, how the payment might not all come in one time, how the payments might be late on like their annuity payments, and how they're left just to starve. One of the great resources that I use is, there's a This American Life podcast called The War on the Prairie. It talks about the Dakota War, the Dakota Massacre, the atrocities that was, you know, and why that all happened. You know, it goes back to the treaties and the broken promises that left this group of people like starving and, you know, without any of their hunting land anymore. So I really make it a point to dive into that stuff so they can understand, you know, that what's written in the Little House is just not so simple, you know, hunky-dory happenings. But there's a whole other side to the story that needs to come out. And that's my intent on teaching this book, is to get that whole other side to come out.
I would like to talk about some of the other elements in the book, and we will talk more about the depiction of Native people. And also, Christine, I hope that as the hour goes on, you'll share some resources that you do recommend for parents and educators to share with their students. I want to talk a little bit about the depiction of nature in both of these books, because one of the things that I really love as a reader about both books is that it gives me a window into the native landscape that, of course, has been so dramatically altered in the Midwest and everywhere in the United States. But of course, we know that we are living in Iowa, which is one of the most altered states in the Union. And that was one of the things that captured my imagination as a child in reading Little House on the Prairie, was her depictions of the prairie and of the animals. And then, unfortunately, I didn't get to read The Birchbark House as a child, but the really incredibly beautiful descriptions of Lake Superior and the forests and the animals in The Birchbark House also just really excite me. And I think that as a child would have really ignited my imagination. And Brent, maybe I'll give you an opportunity to respond to that first, because I know that nature education is a very important part of what you do. What are your feelings about those descriptions?
Yeah, like you said, they're beautiful descriptions, you know, from different perspectives. You know, I always teach my kids at the Good Earth here that, you know, I ask them, what's a percentage of native prairie that is left in the state of Iowa? You know, and they're guessing, you know, 10%, sometimes upwards of 50%. And then they learn that it's 0.1% is left. And so going off of that, you know, to understand that what the nature landscape is and that the people's connection with nature is really important in both of these books. I think one book probably portrays it as, you know, preserving the nature, and other is, you know, with the settlers coming in, is more transforming it. And there's a lot of things to look at there, but definitely the animals and the wildlife and just exploring this land is kind of set up in both books interestingly. So,
Sarah, would you like to weigh in on that?
Well, Laura's just the beautiful descriptions of nature, of things like sunrises and sunsets, of the unending circle that you drive in what is Kansas. It brings the land to life in such a way that if you go down to Independence, Kansas for the Little House on the Prairie site, there isn't a lot as much as the other sites, but you can just see the land exactly like Laura describes it, and it is incredibly moving to see that land, and you really get a lot of that out of the book.
We're talking about Little House on the Prairie by Laura Ingalls Wilder and The Birch Bark House by Louise Erdrich. This is the Talk of Iowa Book Club.
If you love books and this podcast, join IPR's Talk of Iowa Book Club Facebook group. You can ask Charity what she's reading for work or for fun. Get inside information about upcoming book club episodes, answer questions to shape our book discussions, and find other like-minded readers to share observations and recommendations. Join our community of readers in IPR's Talk of Iowa Book Club Facebook group.
This is the Talk of Iowa Book Club. I'm Charity Nebbe. We have been reading two books for young readers, Little House on the Prairie by Laura Ingalls Wilder, published in 1935, and The Birch Bark House by Louise Erdrich, published in 1999. In our book club today, Brent Criswell, fifth grade teacher, Sarah Utoff, a Laura Ingalls Wilder authority, and Christine Nobis, an Indigenous rights activist and organizer. And the descriptions of nature and the natural world are really powerful parts of both of these books. We've already heard from Brent and Sarah, their thoughts on these descriptions. Christine, is there anything you'd like to add about that? Again, so much of this natural world is gone, but there is this glimpse of what was there pre-settlement.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I just noticed the great dichotomies in the book. I really think that the only similarities that these two books have is the fact that there are two little girls living on Turtle Island in the 1800s. Besides that, the lives these families are living are just completely different. And in terms of their relationships with the land and animals also, it's very different. You know, whereas, you know, I know the Little House folks are extremely worried about wolves. You know, like I do know that Indigenous people have a very different relationship with these animals. The same thing with bears, you know, in the Birch Bark House, you know, the bear becomes Makias's, you know, animal spirit. And then, you know, with food, I noticed a very big difference, their diet. You know, the Little House folks eat the colonized diet that was forced upon Indigenous peoples on reservations, which has led to our high rates of diabetes and other diseases. You know, flour, butter, lard, salt and sugar was like the main list of food that I read in Little House. Whereas, you know, in Birch Bark, you know, you have a plethora of different foods that were taken, you know, from the land and more in balance with the land, like, you know, blueberries, deer, fish, And then also, even the homes themselves, you know, the home for the Little House family is static. It's stolen wood taken from the Osage people. You know, they didn't ask. They just came in and they stole it. You know, and then the people, the Anishinaabe living where they are, you know, they would move, you know, depending on the season. So they lived with the seasons, and they the birch bark house is a temporary structure that is built in the summer. And then farming, what about farming? Farming was, you know, one of the most colonized practices that we had and have to this day. I'll just put a little note in here. Iowa is the most biologically colonized state in the country, 90% of it given over to agriculture, and the number one contributor to the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico because of all the chemicals that are coming out of these big ag plants here and farming practices. And so, you know, I look at Birch Bark House and I see, you know, a way of living and being on the land that completely differs from like what the wilders were doing. They were essentially setting up the land for devastation with, you know, their farming practices, which, as we know, has devastated a majority of the world at this point, and also led to the genocide and extermination. Or extermination of indigenous peoples everywhere.
One of the things that Louise Erdrich has written about in writing these books is that she wanted to have an opportunity to preserve some of the historic life ways. And she, again, I'm going to read what she says in an interview. She says, one of the things that I always liked about the Little House on the Prairie books was the specificity of everything the family made or used. Readers have so many images from those books, like how sausages were made, for example, and Ma was always stuffing mattresses with hay. Children were eating pork cracklings, wearing handmade clothing, and using handmade soap. When I began the Birch Bark House, I wanted to have this level of detail too. So I try to actually experience or do in real life almost anything that my characters do in the books. I can't really hunt bears, but I do try to do some of the things that my characters do in the books. And that's, again, that's something that I really loved about the Birch Bark House, because for me, having this not be part of my family heritage, I learned so much about some of the traditional life ways. And Sarah, you talked, I know that that's one of the things that you really love about the Little House on the Prairie books as well, as Louise Erdrich said that she did as well, because you can really look at those books and see how a log cabin was built, or even how to construct a door, or how to dig a well.
Yes, I think that a lot of people come away from reading the book feeling like they could do those things, what the dangers are, what tools you'd use, how it would work. And I'd like to say I agree with the all the food things that she just mentioned, because we do pretty much all those things in the Little House books too. And living with the land is a very important thing.
I want to talk about family in these books, because family is at the core of both of these books. And Christine, I know that you have said that the depiction of the family in the Birch Bark House and the family unit in the Birch Bark House is particularly powerful for you, because as the U.S. government was breaking apart the villages and structure of how Native people lived, they often destroyed the family structure as a way to make those communities weaker. So to have this really beautiful depiction of family life, and authentic depiction of family life, is a really powerful thing.
It is very powerful. It's like I said, there's a lot of dichotomies going on here in these two books, and it's wonderful to see you know, matriarchal practices being carried out in the Birch Bark House, and you know, extended families living together like they should be, and the celebration of family in general, in terms of like not just like the nuclear family, but like how everybody lives together and works together. Whereas there's such a stark difference that you see in Little House on the Prairie, even to the point where they don't like to borrow from each other, and they live miles apart, and there's so much more hardship that they ensue because of it, because there's this real, real
deep-seated want for independence, which I think comes from the idea of manifest destiny and, you know, the doctrine of discovery about moving westward and, you know, every, you know, family just being so hardy and whatever, blah, 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 whatever settlers are. And so, you know, I love that Birch Bark House really did get to the heart of Native culture. The heart of Native culture is family. And so she did a beautiful job of displaying that. And I do think that, you know, Little House on the Prairie does a good job of describing, you know, settler, you know, families and basically what has grown into be the types of family units that we live in today as well. The nuclear family, which has really not turned out the best for anybody in this country.
It does show a very tight family unit that has broken off from their village in Wisconsin in Little House on the Prairie. Sarah, I know that you've found inspiration in that tight family unit. And this is in many ways the way that we live now, except that family was always together.
Yes. I do speeches about Laura, and I mean, people come up to me afterwards and talk about it. And there have been so many people, both in person and online, who've talked what a positive influence it's been on their lives. A lot of these people don't have a solid family. I did, but a lot of people who haven't had that experience kind of get to live it through the books, that they feel that they're part of the family, like it's their ma and pa.
I want to bring a caller into the conversation. Diana and her daughter Amelia are on the line in Cedar Rapids. Hello, Diana.
We are pretty excited. My daughter is 8 and has read both series multiple times, and she encouraged me to read The Birch Bark House, so I got to read both series with her also. So we've talked a lot about the racism that comes into Laura Ingalls books, and I guess in some way my question is for Christine, but to use that book as a perspective about how natives were treated seems like a positive thing that we can take from that book series. You know, it holds a special place in a lot of people's hearts because it was an early read for us, but now as we go into this Black Lives Matter movement, it starts to provide context also for the way, like, especially for me talking to my white children, how racism has been a part of this country for a very long time and how we can see it still continues and what are the things that we can do to try to change that.
Diana, thank you so much for calling. And I'm so glad that Amelia encouraged you to read the books as well. And Christine, I don't want to put this all on your shoulders, but you have some suggestions for other resources that parents and teachers could turn to deepen their understanding of this time period and of the Holocaust perpetrated against Native people.
Yeah, I do. My question really is why are certain books removed from the shelves for children, and why are certain books allowed to stay up? You know, so racism in this book and the whitewashing of the actual experience is really disturbing. And so if this book is to stay on the shelves, like, I believe that there needs to be some kind of forward put onto it. I believe that it needs to be marketed in a different way, and it could be used as a tool to teach people how settlers viewed Native people back in that time. So it can be used in that context. And that context only, you know, but the fact that it's still out there in children's sections and available to anybody to purchase without any context is really disturbing to me. If teachers are going to teach this in their classes, I do appreciate the fact that it is, you know, for instance, this one particular grade 5 class is getting it taught with Birch Bark House. And other, you know, books and being contextualized, but are other teachers doing that? We don't know. I do like to recommend, every year I give to my children's teachers and principals a book called Rethinking Columbus, The Next 500 Years, Resources for Teaching About the Impact of the Arrival of Columbus in the Americas, which is a teacher's guide to introducing different curriculum that basically talks against so many of the issues that we have in our classrooms.
Christine, thank you so much for being part of this conversation. I really appreciate your perspective and that you were willing to read these books for us. Christine Nobis is Plains Cree Soto of the George Gordon First Nation in Saskatchewan. She is shift director and decolonizer with Seeding Sovereignty. Thank you also to our other expert readers, Sarah Utoff, a Laura Ingalls Wilder authority. She's also an authority on one-room schools, historic foodways, and living history. Her website is trundlebedtales.com. And Brent Criswell, a fifth-grade public school teacher who also helps to run The Good Earth, providing nature-based education. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is the Talk of Iowa Book Club. See you next time. The Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast is produced by Caitlin Harrop and edited by Monica Starr. We get technical support from Dennis Reese, and our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. This podcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio.
If you like the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast, check out another great podcast from Iowa Public Radio, Under the Golden Dome. Host John Pemble takes you inside the Iowa State House to hear decisions being made in committee rooms or on the floor of the House and Senate. Not only do you hear from the lawmakers crafting legislation each week, but also the Iowans who will be impacted by the policies being debated. A new season of Under the Golden Dome begins each January with the Iowa legislative session. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts.